LeBanon found the ship too small to contain the enormous restlessness that filled him. The women sat under their little awning, and the wizards sat under theirs like ducks in a row. But he paced up and down, impatient with the narrow confines of the deck. He felt it was his impatience and not the wind that sent Dolphin running so fast to the south, but never fast enough. He wanted the journey over.
"Remember the fleet on the way to Wathort?"
Tossler said, joining him while he stood near the steersman, studying the chart and the clear sea air before them. "That was a grand sight. 30 ships a line." "I wish it was Wathort we were bound for," LeBanon said.
"I never did like Roke,"
Tossler agreed.
"Not an honest wind or current for 20 miles off that shore, but only wizards brew. And the rocks north of it, never in the same place twice. The town full of cheats and shapeshifters."
He spat confidently to leeward.
"I'd rather meet old Gore and his slavers again."
LeBanon nodded, but said nothing. That was often the pleasure of Tossler's company. He said what LeBanon felt it was better that he himself not say.
"Who was the dumb man, the mute?" Tossler asked. "The one that killed Falcon on the wall?"
"Egre. Pirate turned slave taker."
"That's it. He knew you there at Sora. Went right for you. I always wondered how."
"Because he took me as a slave once." It was not easy to surprise Tossler, but the seaman looked at him with his mouth open, evidently not believing him, but not able to say so, and so with nothing to say. LeBanon enjoyed the effect for a moment, and then took pity on him. "When the Archmage took me hunting after Cobb, we went south first. A man in Hort Town betrayed us to the slave takers. They knocked the Archmage on the head, and I ran off thinking I could lead them away from him. But it was me they were after. I was saleable. I woke up chained in a galley bound for Seoul. He rescued me before the next night passed. The irons fell off us all like bits of dead leaves, and he told Egre not to speak again until he found something worth saying. He came to that galley like a great light over the water. I never knew what he was till then." Tossler mulled this over for a while.
"He unchained all the slaves? Why didn't the others kill Egre?"
"Well, maybe they took him onto Seoul and sold him," LeBanon said. Tossler mulled a while longer.
"So that's why you were so keen to do away with the slave trade."
"One reason."
"Doesn't improve the character as a rule,"
Tossler observed. He studied the chart of the inmost sea tacked on the board to the steersman's left.
"Island of Wei," he remarked. "Where the dragon woman's from?"
"You keep clear of her, I notice." Tossler pursed his lips, though he did not whistle, being aboard ship.
"You know that song I mentioned about the Lass of Belilo? Well, I never thought of it as anything but a tale until I saw her."
"I doubt she'd eat you, Tossler."
"Well, it would be a glorious death,"
the sailor said rather sourly. The king laughed.
"Don't push your own luck," said Tossler.
"No fear."
"You and she were talking there so free and easy, like making yourself easy with a volcano, to my mind. But I'll tell you, I wouldn't mind seeing a bit more of that present the Karg sent you. There's a sight worth seeing in there, to judge by the feet. But how do you get it out of the tent?"
"The feet are grand. But I'd like a bit more ankle to begin with." LeBanon felt his face turn grim and turned aside to keep Tossler from seeing it.
"If anybody gave me a package like that,"
Tossler said, staring out over the sea,
"I'd open it."
LeBanon could not restrain a slight movement of impatience. Tossler saw it. He was quick. He grinned his wry grin and said no more. The ship's master had come out on deck, and LeBanon engaged him in talk. "Looks a bit thick ahead," he said, and the master nodded. "Thunder squalls to the south and west there. We'll be in them tonight." The sea grew choppier as the afternoon drew on. The benign sunlight took on a brassy tinge, and gusts of wind blew from one quarter, then another. Tanar had told the Bannon that the princess was afraid of the sea and of seasickness, and he glanced back once or twice at the after cabin, expecting to see no red-veiled form among the ducks in a row. But it was Tanar and Tahanu who had gone in. The princess was still there, and Irian was sitting beside her. They were talking earnestly. What on earth did a dragon woman from Wei have to talk about with a harem woman from Hur-At-Hur? What language had they in common? The question seemed so much in need of answering to Lebanon that he walked aft. When he got there, Irian looked up at him and smiled. She had a strong, open face, a broad smile. She went barefoot by choice, was careless about her dress, let the wind tangle her hair. Altogether, she seemed no more than a handsome, hot-hearted, intelligent, untaught countrywoman, till you saw her eyes. They were the color of smoky amber, and when she looked straight at Lebanon, as she was doing now, he could not meet them. He looked down. He had made it clear that there was to be no courtly ceremony on the ship, no bows and courtesies. Nobody was to leap up when he came near. But the princess had got to her feet. They were, as Tossler had observed, beautiful feet. Not small, but high-arched, strong and fine. He looked at them, the two slender feet on the white wood of the deck. He looked up from them and saw that the princess was doing as she had done the last time he faced her, parting her veil so that he, though no one else, could see her face. He was a little staggered by the stern, almost tragic beauty of the face in that red shadow. Is everything all right, princess? He asked, stammering, a thing he very seldom did. She said, "My friend Tanar said, breathe wind." "Yes," he said, rather at random. "Is there anything your wizards could do for her, do you think, maybe?" said Irian, unfolding her long limbs and standing up too. She and the princess were both tall women. Lebanon was trying to make out what color the princess's eyes were since he was able to look at them. They were blue, he thought, but like blue opals, they held other colors in them, or maybe it was the sunlight coming through the red of her veils. Do for her? She wants very much not to be seasick. She had a terrible time of it coming from the Kargish places. "I will not to fear," the princess said. She gazed straight at him as if challenging him to what? "Of course," he said, "of course. I'll ask Onyx. I'm sure there's something he can do." He made a sketchy bow to them both and went off hurriedly to find the wizard. Onyx and Seppel conferred and then consulted Alder. A spell against seasickness was more in the province of sorcerers, menders, healers, than of learned and powerful wizards. Alder could not do anything himself at present, of course, but he might remember a charm. He did not, having never dreamed of going to sea until his troubles began. Seppel confessed that he himself always got seasick in small boats or rough weather. Onyx finally went to the after cabin and begged the princess's pardon. He himself had no skill to help her and nothing to offer her but, apologetically, a charm or talisman one of the sailors, hearing of her plight, the sailors heard everything, had pressed upon him to give her. The princess's long-fingered hand emerged from the red and gold veils. The wizard placed in it a queer little black-and-white object, dried seaweed braided round a bird's breastbone. "A petrel, because they ride the storm," Onyx said, shamefaced. The princess bowed her unseen head and murmured thanks in Kargish. The fetish disappeared within her veils. She withdrew to the cabin. Onyx, meeting the king quite nearby, apologized to him. The ship was pitching energetically now in hard, erratic gusts on a choppy sea, and he said, "I could, you know, sire, say a word to the winds." Lebanon knew well that there were two schools of thought concerning weather working. The old-fashioned one, that of the bagman, who ordered the winds to serve their ships as shepherds, order their dogs to run here and there, and the newfangled notion, a few centuries old at most, of the Roque school, that the Mage Wind might be raised at real need, but it was best to let the world's winds blow. He knew that Onyx was a devout upholder of the way of Roque. "Use your own judgment, Onyx," he said, "if it seems we're in for a really bad night. But if it's no more than a few squalls..." Onyx looked up at the masthead, where already a wisp or two of fallow fire had flickered in the cloud-darkened dusk. Thunder rumbled grandly in the blackness before them, all across the south. Behind them, the last of the daylight fell wan, tremulous across the waves. "Very well," he said, rather dismally, and went below to the small, crowded cabin. LeBannon stayed out of that cabin almost entirely, sleeping on deck when he slept at all. Tonight was not one for sleep for anybody on the Dolphin. It was not a single squall, but a chain of violent late-summer storms boiling up out of the southwest, and between the terrific commotion of the lightning-dazzled sea, the thunder crashes that seemed about to knock the ship apart, and the crazy storm gusts that kept her pitching and rolling and taking queer jumps, it was a long night, and a loud one. Onyx consulted LeBannon once. Should he say a word to the wind? LeBannon looked to the master, who shrugged. He and his crew were busy enough, but unconcerned. The ship was in no trouble. As for the women folk, they were reported to be sitting up in their cabin, gambling. Irian and the princess had come out on deck earlier, but it was hard to stay afoot at times, and they had seen they were in the crew's way, so they had retired. The report that they were gambling came from the cook's boy, who had been sent to see if they wanted anything to eat. They had wanted whatever he could bring. LeBannon found himself possessed by the same intense curiosity he had felt in the afternoon. There was no doubt the lamps were all alight in the stern cabin, for the glow of them streamed out golden on the foam and race of the ship's wake. About midnight he went aft and knocked. Irian opened the door. After the dazzle and blackness of the storm, the lamplight in the cabin seemed warm and steady, though the swinging lamps cast swinging shadows, and he was confusedly aware of colors, the soft, various colors of the women's clothes, their skin, brown or pale or gold, their hair black or gray or tawny, their eyes, the princess's eyes staring at him, startled as she snatched up a scarf or some cloth to hold before her face. "Oh, we thought it was the cook's boy," Irian said with a laugh. Tahanu looked at him and said in her shy, comradely way, "Is there trouble?" He realized that he was standing in the doorway, staring at them like some speechless messenger of doom. "No, none at all. Are you getting on all right? I'm sorry, it's been so rough." "We don't hold you answerable for the weather," Tanar said. "Nobody could sleep, so the princess and I have been teaching the others Kargish gambling." He saw five-sided ivory dice sticks scattered over the table, probably tosslers. "We've been betting islands," Irian said. "But Tehanu and I are losing. The Kargs have already won Ark and Ilion." The princess had lowered the scarf. She sat facing LeBannon, resolutely, extremely tense, as a young swordsman might face him before a fencing match. In the warmth of the cabin they were all bare-armed and barefoot, but her consciousness of her uncovered face drew his consciousness as a magnet draws a pin. "I'm sorry it's been so rough," he said again, idiotically, and closed the door. As he turned away he heard them all laughing. He went to stand by the steersman. Looking into the gusty, rainy darkness lit by fitful, distant lightning, he could still see everything in the stern cabin. The black fall of Tahanu's hair, Tanar's affectionate, teasing smile, the dice on the table, the princess's round arms, honey-colored like the lamplight, her throat in the shadow of her hair. Though he did not remember looking at her arms and throat, but only at her face. At her eyes, full of defiance, despair. What was the girl afraid of? Did she think he wanted to hurt her? A star or two was shining out high in the south.
He went to his crowded cabin, slung a hammock, for the bunks were full, and slept for a few hours. He woke before dawn, restless as ever, and went up on the deck. The day came as bright and calm as if no storm had ever been. Labanon stood at the forward rail and saw the first sunlight strike across the water. And an old song came into his mind. Oh, my joy, before bright Ea was, before Segoy bade the islands be, the morning wind blew on the sea. Oh, my joy, be free. It was a fragment of a ballad or lullaby from his childhood. He could remember no more of it. The tune was sweet. Sang it softly and let the wind take the words from his lips. Tanar emerged from the cabin and, seeing him, came to him. Good morning, my dear lord, he said. And he greeted her fondly, with some memory that he had been angry at her, but not knowing why he had been or how he could have been. Did you Kargs win Havnor last night? He asked. No, you may keep Havnor. We went to bed. All the young ones are still there, lolling. Shall we, what is it, lift Roke today? Raise Roke? No, not until early tomorrow. But before noon we should be in Thwil Harbor if they let us come to the island. Now, what do you mean? Roke defends itself from unwelcome visitors. Oh, Ged told me about that. He was on a ship trying to sail back there, and they sent the wind against him. The Roke wind, he called it. Against him? It was a long time ago. He smiled with pleasure at his incredulity, his unwillingness that any affront should ever have been offered to Ged. And when he was a boy who had meddled with the darkness, that's what he said. When he was a man, he still meddled with it. Well, he doesn't now, Benaya said, serene. No, it's we who have to. His face had grown somber. I wish I knew what we're meddling with. I am certain that things are drawing to some great chance or change, as Ogion foretold, as Ged told Alder. And I'm certain that Roke is where we need to be to meet it. But beyond that, no certainty. Nothing. I don't know what it is we face. When Ged took me into the dark land, we knew our enemy. When I took the fleet to Sora, I knew what the evil was I wanted to undo. But now, are the dragons our enemies or our allies? What has gone wrong? What is it we must do, or undo? Will the masters of Roke be able to tell us, or will they turn their wind against us? Fearing the dragon, the one they know, or the one they don't know. Tanar's face was sober, too, but gradually it broke into a smile. What a ragbag you are bringing them, to be sure, he said. A sorcerer with nightmares? A wizard from Palm, two dragons and two Kargs. The only respectable passengers on this ship are you and Onyx. Labanon could not laugh. If only he were with us, he said. Tanar put her hand on his arm. He started to speak, and then did not. He laid his hand over hers. They stood silent thus for some time, side by side, looking out at the dancing sea. The princess has something she wants to tell you before we come to Roke, Tanar said. It's a story from Hur At-Hur. Off there in their desert, they remember things. I think this goes back before anything I ever heard, except the story of the woman of Kamai. It has to do with dragons. It would be kind of you to invite her so that she doesn't have to ask. Aware of the care and caution with which he spoke, he felt a moment of impatience, a flick of shame. He watched, far south across the sea, the course of a galley bound for Kemeri or Wei, the faint, tiny flash of the lifted sweeps. He said, Of course. About noon? Thank you.
About noon, he sent a young seaman to the stern cabin to request the princess to join the king on the foredeck. She emerged at once, and the ship being only about 50 feet long, he could observe her entire progress towards him. Not a long walk, though perhaps for her it was a long one, for it was not a featureless red cylinder that approached him, but a tall young woman. She wore soft white trousers, a long shirt of dull red, a gold circlet that held a very thin red veil over her face and head. The veil fluttered in the sea wind. The young sailor led her round the various obstacles, and up and down the descents and ascents of the crowded, cumbered, narrow deck. She walked slowly and proudly. She was barefoot. Every eye in the ship was on her. She arrived on the foredeck and stood still. Labanan bowed. "Your presence honors us, princess." She performed a deep, straight-backed courtesy and said, "Thank you. You were not ill last night, I hope?" She put her hand on the charm she wore on the cord round her neck, a small bone tied with black, showing it to him. "Keres Akath, Akathawa Erevi," she said.
He knew the word Akath in Kargish meant sorcerer or sorcery. There were eyes everywhere. Eyes in hatchways. Eyes in the rigging. Eyes that were like augers, like gimlets. "Come forward, if you will. We may see Roke Island soon," he said, though there was not the remotest chance of seeing a glimmer of Roke till dawn. With a hand under her elbow, though not actually touching her, he guided her up the steep slant of the deck to the forepeak, where between a capstan, the slant of the bowsprit, and the port rail was a little triangle of decking that, when a sailor had scurried away with the cable he was mending, they had quite to themselves. They were as visible as ever to the rest of the ship, but they could turn their backs on it, as much privacy as royalty can hope for. When they had gained this tiny haven, the princess turned to him and pushed back the veil from her face. He had intended to ask what he could do for her, but the question seemed both inadequate and irrelevant. He said nothing.
She said, "Lord King, in Hur-at-Hur, I am Fayagat. In Roke Island, I am to be king's daughter of Kargad. To be this, I am not Fayagat. I am Bareface, if it please you." After a moment, he said, "Yes, yes, princess. This is well done. It please you?" "Very much. Yes. I thank you, princess." "Barizu," she said, a regal acceptance of his thanks. Her dignity abashed him. Her face had been flaming red when she first put back the veil. There was no color in it now. But she stood straight and still, and gathered up her forces for another speech. "Two," she said, "also, my friend Tenar." "Our friend Tenar," he said with a smile. "Our friend Tenar. She says I am to tell King Labanan of the Vedunan." He repeated the word. Long ago, Karg people, sorcery people, dragon people, yes? All people one, all speak one. Wulua Mekreft. One language. Ha, yes, one language. In her passionate attempt to speak Hardik, to tell him what she wanted to tell him, she was losing her self-consciousness. Her face and eyes shone. "But then, dragon people say, let go all things, fly. But we people, we say, no, keep all things, dwell. So we go apart, huh? Dragon people and we people? So they make the Vedurnan. These two let go. these to keep, yes? But to keep all things, we must to let go that language, that dragon people language, the old speech. Yes, so we people, we let go that old speech language and keep all things. And dragon people let go all things, but keep that language, huh? Sena, this is the Vedurnan. Her beautiful, large, long hands gestured eloquently, and she watched his face with eager hope of understanding. We go east, east, east. Dragon people go west, west. We dwell. They fly. Oh, some dragon come east with us, but not keep the language, forget, and forget to fly, like Karg people. Karg people speak Karg language, not dragon language. All keep the Vedurnan east, west. Sena? But in... At a loss, she brought her hands together from her east and west, and Labanan said, in the middle.
Ah, yes, oh, in the middle.
She laughed with the pleasure of getting the word.
In the middle? You, sorcery people, huh? You, middle people, speak Hardik language, but too, also keep to speak old speech language. You learn it. Like I learn Hardik, huh? Learn to speak. Then, oh, this is the bad thing. Then you say, in that sorcery language, in that old speech language, you say, we will not to die. And it is so. And the Vedurnan is broken. Her eyes were like blue fire. After a moment she asked, Seneha?
I'm not sure I understand.
You keep life. You keep too long. You never to let go. But to die... She threw her hands out in a great opening gesture, as if she threw something away into the air, across the water. He shook his head regretfully. Ah, she said. She thought a minute, but no words came. Defeated, she moved her hands, palms down, in a graceful pantomime of relinquishment. I must to learn more words, she said.
Princess, the master patterner of Roke, the master of the grove. He watched her for comprehension and began again. On Roke Island, there is a man, a great mage, who is a Karg. You can tell him what you have told me, in your own language. She listened intently and nodded. She said, the friend of Irian, I will in my heart to talk to this man. Her face was bright with the thought. That touched Labanan. He said, I'm sorry you have been lonely here, princess. She looked at him, alert and luminous, but did not reply. I hope, as time goes on, as you learn the language.
I learn quick, she said.
He did not know if it was a statement or a prediction. They were looking straight at each other. She resumed her stately attitude and spoke formally, as she had at the beginning.
I thank you to listen, Lord King.
She dipped her head and shielded her eyes in a formal sign of respect, and made the deep knee-bend courtesy again, speaking some formula in Kargish.
Please, he said, tell me what you said.
She paused, hesitated, thought, and replied,
Your small kings.
Oh, sons. Sons. Your sons. Let them to be dragons and kings of dragons. Huh? She smiled radiantly, let the veil fall over her face, backed away 4 steps, turned and departed, lithe and sure-footed down the length of the ship. Labanon stood as if last night's lightning had struck him at last. Chapter 5. Rejoining. The last night of the sea voyage was calm, warm, starless. Dolphin moved with a long, easy rocking over the smooth swells southward. It was easy to sleep, and the people slept, and sleeping, dreamed.
Alder dreamed of a little animal that came in the dark and touched his hand. He could not see what it was, and when he reached out to it, it was gone, lost. Again, he felt the small, velvet muzzle touch his hand. He half roused, and the dream slipped from him, but the piercing ache of loss was in his heart.
In the bunk below him, Seppel dreamed that he was in his own house in Ferrau on Palm, reading an old lore book from the dark time, content with his work. But he was interrupted. Someone wanted to see him. It will only take a minute, he told himself, and went to speak to the caller. It was a woman. Her hair was dark with a glint of red in it. Her face was beautiful and full of trouble. You must send him to me, she said. You will send him to me, won't you? He thought, I don't know who she means, but I must pretend I do. And he said, that will not be easy, you know. At that, the woman drew her hand back, and he saw that she held a stone, a heavy stone. Startled, he thought she meant to throw it at him or strike him down with it, and recoiling from her, he woke in the darkness of the cabin. He lay listening to the breathing of the other sleepers, and the whisper of the sea along the ship's side. In his bunk on the other side of the small cabin, Onyx lay on his back, gazing into the dark. He thought his eyes were open. He thought he was awake. But he thought that many small, thin cords had been tied around his arms and legs and hands and head, and that all these cords ran out into the darkness, over land and sea, over the curve of the world, and the cords were drawing him, tugging him, so that he and the ship he was in and all its passengers were being pulled gently, gently to the place where the sea dried up, where the ship would go aground silently on blind sands. But he could not speak or do anything, because the cords tied shut his jaws, his eyelids.
Labanon had come down to the cabin to sleep for a while, wanting to be fresh at dawn when they might raise Roke Island. He slept quickly and deeply, and his dreams fleeted and changed. A high green hill above the sea, a woman who smiled and, lifting her hand, showed him she could make the sunrise. A claimant in his court of justice in Havnor, from whom he learned to his horror and shame that half the people of the kingdom were starving to death in locked rooms beneath houses. A child who cried out to him, come to me, but he could not find the child. As he slept, his right hand held the rock and the little amulet bag at his throat, clenched it tight.
In the deck cabin above these dreamers, the women dreamed. Sesarach walked up into the mountains, the beautiful dear desert mountains of her home. But she was walking on the forbidden way, the dragon path. Human feet must not walk that path, must not even cross it. The dust of it was smooth and warm under her bare soles, and though she knew she must not walk on it, she walked on, until she looked up and saw that the mountains were not those she knew, but were black, jagged precipices which she could never climb. Yet she must climb them. Irion flew joyous on the storm wind, but the storm sent loops of lightning up over her wings, drawing her down and down towards the clouds. And as she was pulled nearer and nearer, she saw that they were not clouds, but black rocks, a black and jagged mountain range. Her wings were tied to her sides by cords of lightning, and she fell. Tehanu crawled through a tunnel deep underground. There was not enough air to breathe, and the tunnel grew narrower as she crawled. She could not turn back, but the glimmering roots of trees, growing down through the dirt into the tunnel, gave her handhold sometimes by which she could pull herself on into the dark.
Tanar climbed up the steps of the throne of the Nameless Ones in the sacred place of Atuan. She was very small and the steps were very high, so that she could climb them only laboriously. But when she reached the fourth step, she did not pause and turn around, as the priestess had told her she must do. She went on. She climbed the next step, and the next, and the next. In dust so thick it had obliterated the steps, and she must feel for the levels where no foot had ever trodden. She went hastily, because behind the empty throne Ged had left something, or lost something. Something of great importance to myriads of people, and she had to find it. Only she did not know what it was. A stone. A stone, she told herself. But behind the throne, when she crawled there at last, was only dust, owl's droppings, and dust.
In the alcove of the old mage's house on the Overfell of Gaunt, Ged dreamed that he was Archmage. He was talking with his friend Thorian as they walked the corridor of runes toward the meeting room of the Masters of the School. "I had no power at all," he told Thorian earnestly, "for years and years." The summoner smiled and said, "That was only a dream, you know." But Ged was troubled by the long black wings that trailed behind him through the corridor. He shrugged his shoulders, trying to lift the wings, but they dragged on the floor like empty sacks. "Do you have wings?" he asked Thorian, who said, "Oh, yes," complacently showing him how his wings were tied tight against his back and legs by many small thin cords. "I am well yoked."
Among the trees of the imminent grove on Roke Island, Asver the Patterner slept, as often he did in summer, in an open glade near the eastern edge of the wood, where he could look up and see the stars through the leaves. There, his sleep was light, transparent, his mind moving from thought to dream and back, guided by the movements of the stars and leaves as they changed places in their dance. But tonight, there were no stars, and the leaves hung still. He looked up into the lightless sky and saw through the clouds. In the high black sky were stars, small, bright, and still. They did not move. He knew there would be no sunrise. He sat up then, awake, gazing into the faint, soft light that always hung in the aisles of the trees. His heart beat slow and hard. In the great house, the young men, sleeping, turned and cried out, dreaming that they must go fight an army on a plain of dust. But the warriors they must fight were old men, old women, weak, sick people, weeping children. The Masters of Roke dreamed that a ship was sailing towards them over the sea, heavy laden, low in the water. One dreamed that the freight of the ship was black rock. Another dreamed she carried burning fire. Another dreamed that her cargo was dreams. The seven masters who slept in the great house woke, one and then another, in their stone sleeping cells, made a little warelight, and got up. They found the doorkeeper already afoot and waiting at the door. "The king will come," he said with a smile, "at daybreak."